in Majd al-Shams, it was quite divided. Very impressive people, I must say. The young people are very impressive. Part of them went through an Israelization process. They don't serve in the army like the other Jews in Israel. But I could feel, I wasn't there for a few years, I could feel that the young generation is getting much more Israeli than their parents, and they were also asking for more and more Israeli citizenship because they realized that that's their key for good life.
I want to ask Karim Makdisi in Beirut. So the Israel did then attack a building in Beirut. If you can give us the details of what happened and talk about the Hezbollah commander who they say they killed, though we're just reporting that. We don't actually know. It has been said that he was in that building and many people were killed there.
Yes, this was, you know, last night in the evening when people were having dinner or people were outside in the streets and you know, just moving around. And there were some drone attacks by the Israelis. They hit, it's an extremely, you know, Beirut is a very, very dense city. In the suburb, the Dahiya, there were the suburbs of Beirut where these guys were located, is an extremely, exceptionally kind of dense civilian population. So these missiles or these drones hit this residential building. And if you see pictures of it, you see that it's been mostly destroyed. So there's, I think last I checked, there were maybe between 70 and 80 that were wounded. There have been four that are dead, including two children that they took from the rubble, Hassan and Amira Fadlallah, who were caught, who were found, you know, embracing each other under the rubble and had died in this case. And this has created an incredibly difficult moment for people there and for people in Beirut and across Lebanon. And at the other hand, it's also something which is very familiar. The Israelis have been attacking Beirut, have been attacking Lebanon for decades, I mean, since before I was born. There's just been nonstop invasions, attacks. So these kinds of things are not new in the kind of bloodlust and the history of Israeli attacks in Lebanon. But what is different now is the response. That I would say that since the 2006 war, there has been a kind of deterrence that had been established where prior to that, if the Israelis decided they want to take out a building, they want to kill people, they want to do things, they would do this with total impunity, with, of course, American support and total impunity, and nothing really could be done. Since 2006 war, and increasingly, and particularly, you know, as Hezbollah became more and more powerful and, you know, recruited more people and trained more people, became more professional, much better equipment, etc., the deterrence that was established means at the moment that if the Israelis, this is according to Hezbollah and according to Hassan Nasrallah, if the Israelis attack Beirut, there will have to be some kind of response. I just want to make one point from, you know, that was, you know, previously discussed. The idea of Majd al-Shams in the Golan, I want to reiterate that this was not Israel, and this was occupied Syrian territory. The Druze are there. All the Druze that were killed did not have Israeli citizenship, as far as I know. So the Israeli, you know, kind of claim to say they wanted self-defense or use international law. All of this was total mumbo-jumbo. It's a totally illegal and immoral attack. And we know for sure that Netanyahu, as you said in the clip before this, that, you know, they were basically hounded out when they came to the funeral. When they came to check in, they were told to leave and told not to take any kind of revenge. We know that Netanyahu and his government do not care about children. So this kind of fake tears about the children, the Druze children in Majd al-Shams, which is an incredible tragedy, is total nonsense. This was an excuse. It's extremely important to remember that Netanyahu was in the U.S. There was that grotesque event at the Congress where people were giving him standing ovations in this talk and which he was doing inside the U.S. Congress, which was broadcast across the world, which really weakens U.S. standing and shows the kind of relationship between Netanyahu and the Israelis and the Americans. This is something which Hezbollah, which people in Lebanon, which people in the region all observe very carefully, the way in which Netanyahu was in America, was given these standing ovations, was effectively, as far as people are concerned here, were given the green light to attack not just Lebanon, but also Iraq and Iran. Surely the Americans knew about this. So this idea of a Biden administration, which has been a very pro-genocide as far as a vast majority of the world, and certainly in this region are concerned, has been complicit in the genocide against Palestinians. They have been complicit in protecting the Israelis at all costs, at the international level, at every possible corner, for prosecution against the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, all of these at the UN Security Council, all of the avenues the U.S. has been helping Israel and providing weapons at a daily basis, whenever, without which the Israelis simply could not prosecute any of these kinds of wars. So it's really important to try to understand what is the U.S. role. The U.S. could stop this in an instant. The U.S. could have forced Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire. All this business of Anthony Blinken and others who are extremely complicit in the genocide in Palestine, where they came and the American mediators were briefing, even in Lebanon, just before the attack, they were briefing that, Beirut, the Israelis won't attack Beirut. It'll be a kind of symbolic attack. So clearly, those kind of briefings were part of a misinformation campaign that was being launched to try to take people by surprise. The U.S. can stop this. The U.S. has the tools to do so, to compel Netanyahu. And the way to do this is to do an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, to stop the genocide, and to try to stop this movement, this inexorable movement to a regional war. And I think this is what people here are extremely concerned about. We've lived through wars. We've grown up in these wars. This is the first time the Israelis are experiencing this kind of these kinds of attacks and the this kind of displacement. And this will get much worse for the Israelis as well. So let us hope that the Americans are able to rein back Netanyahu rather than give him these standing ovations to a war criminal, to somebody who is presiding over an apartheid genocidal state, and somebody who has a personal interest, as your guests are saying, a personal interest to prolong the war, to drag the America in at a time when President Biden is both extremely supportive and at the same time, he seems to have lost the reins. I mean, the American government now seems to be missing in action. And this is extremely dangerous. And Netanyahu is trying to take advantage of this.
I wanted to follow up on that, Karima. You mentioned the Biden administration's role right now. The Biden administration's envoys, Amos Hochstein, has visited Beirut several times. Could you explain who he is and what his role has been in the negotiations between Israel and Lebanon?
Yeah, sure. So Amos Hochstein, in fact, is an Israeli citizen. He's an Israeli-American, very close to Biden, and his advisor on energy issues and other kinds of issues. And he was, he mediated between Lebanon and various Lebanese and the Israelis when it came to the maritime boundary. There was an agreement that was signed last year. And that was fairly successful, frankly. And, he's one of these people that kind of operates behind the scenes and doesn't make big declarations, which is good for a mediator. But he is an Israeli. So the idea was that he was supposed to be continuing his mediation to try to, very importantly, during this, over the past several months, one of the main aims to try to de-escalate. I mean, they did not want a regional war. The U.S. at least had, keep proclaiming it does not want the expansion of the war. The U.S. very much supports the genocide in Gaza, but it's against having a kind of larger regional war. Hochstein was his emissary, and the messages came through, let's de-escalate, let's try to pull back to the kind of UN resolutions 1701, which kind of ended the war in 2006. Have Hezbollah kind of, at least its armed presence, at least the visible presence kind of be withdrawn from there, and the Israelis will stop the overflights, this kind of thing. But the central part, which is simply not workable, was that he was trying to de-link Lebanon, or the let's say the Israeli northern front, Lebanon southern front, with Gaza. So the idea was to say, let's de-escalate here while whatever goes on in Gaza is separate. That is not workable. It's something which Hezbollah has said from October 8th that this is not acceptable, that the front will continue to be open until a permanent, what's called the permanent ceasefire is reached in Gaza and the genocide ends. Until that moment, there will not be an end to the war here. The U.S. government knows this very well. So the emissary, Hochstein, as I said, who is an Israeli, has a lot of contacts here, is fairly well regarded in general. But at the same time, it's very clear that his mission was to try to de-link Lebanon from Gaza. And that's something that's impossible, both in terms of the historical context, in terms of the political context, and the fact that Hezbollah is not in that position where it will take, where it will just kind of, go away and not achieve its own political objectives, for nothing. You know, so the idea of a deterrence that happened after 2006 is very much here. The idea that the Israelis will be able to dictate the settlement across the border between the Lebanese and the Israelis is absolutely not workable. The idea that Hezbollah will somehow disappear or disarm or, you know, all this stuff is totally unimaginable outside of a ceasefire in Gaza and outside of a larger kind of just settlement where the Palestinians receive their liberation and their self-determination. The rest is not going to happen. And the worry, of course, if I can add one more point, is that there's this larger axis, you know, what's called this axis of resistance, which Hezbollah in Lebanon is at the center of it, along with Iran, along with the Houthis in Yemen, and in Iraq and in Syria. There are all these different forces that have been kind of operating as a support front for Hamas and for Islamic Jihad in Gaza. And so you've got this for the first time, this larger regional dimension, which is engaged militarily, as you know, from Yemen to Lebanon. This now is at a balance. The question is, if the Israelis do what I think Netanyahu wants to do, which is to draw Lebanon into a much larger war and draw Hezbollah into a much larger war, that would draw the Iranians in, which is why they assassinated Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in full view. And this is something clearly to try to provoke an Iranian response, which they've already said they're going to have to respond. Lebanon, Hezbollah, there has to be a response. Netanyahu and his religious fundamentalists in government would like such a response to draw the United States in. Everybody can see this, and everybody can see that this is heading towards a regional war. And this is why I find it, and many people here find it incredible, that the U.S. administration, that the U.S. government is unable to stop this slide to war. So with or without a mediator in Lebanon, the mediation is done behind the scenes, but it is entirely useless and won't have any teeth absent a ceasefire in Gaza. This is the way it is.
I'd like to bring in, if I can, Gideon Levy on this whole issue of the larger significance of the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, and also in Iran. The attack occurred in Iran. What could potentially be the Iranian response?
Nobody can tell, but the signs are very, very worrying. It was an irresponsible act by Israel, no doubt, because Israel cannot guarantee what will be the Iranian reaction. And this time it involves Iran. Don't forget that Iran feels responsible for Haniyeh because he was a frequent guest in Tehran and he was quite appreciated there. And as such, killing him on Iranian soil has a special meaning for Iran. If Iran will not react, which I totally don't believe, but if they will not react, their position as heading this whole group of countries and organizations fighting for Palestine will totally be questioned and doubted, because here you are, until now you only used your proxies, but now when there is an attack on your own soil, you keep passive. I can't believe this will happen. And obviously, anyone who goes for such an operation and does not take into account the risks, and the risks are enormous, is irresponsible. And therefore, those hours will be very crucial, maybe the coming days. But I cannot see that this will end up in any good way. The only question is, how big will the catastrophe be?
We just have 1 minute. We're ending with Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, joining us from Boston. The significance of Ismail Haniyeh, his assassination, and what you feel, being in Boston yourself, should be response of the Biden administration. Already, Antony Blinken has said, we had no foreknowledge of this. Netanyahu had just left the United States after going to the U.S. Congress joint session speech. He went down and met with Donald Trump and Mar-a-Lago, came back and led the assassination, at least they claim, of the commander, Hezbollah leader in Beirut. And now Ismail Haniyeh, his meaning to Palestinians.
Ismail Haniyeh's meaning is that he has been a high official in Hamas really since 2007, 2006 when Hamas won the democratic elections in Palestine, which the U.S., by the way, was, you know, happy to help take place. But when Hamas won, the U.S. and Israel immediately sanctioned the Palestinians. So the Haniyeh's importance is he's been there a long time, near or at the top of Hamas's political leadership. The military leadership is a separate unit, but they obviously coordinate here and there. He is important also because he has been sort of on the pragmatic side of the political leadership. He wrote to President Bush in 2006, right after he became prime minister of Palestine, and at one point unified Palestine with Fatah and Hamas together in the government. And he said to Bush, look, you're a big democracy. We're a democratic country with our elections. We should be talking to each other. And he said that Hamas supports a long-term truce with Israel. In other words, ending the state of armed conflict, trying to negotiate a permanent resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian or the Arabist-Zionist confrontation that's gone on for 100 years now. So he represents that side of Hamas, and Hamas has made 6 or 7 such overtures in the last 15 years, all of which have been ignored by Israel and the United States. So the killing Haniyeh really is a sign from the Israelis that they're not interested in negotiating the ceasefire, the hostage release, prisoner exchanges. They just want to assert Zionist Jewish supremacy in all of Palestine and control the powers around the region. This is the great challenge now to the world, to rein in Israel, to create a situation where people put some meat onto the bones of the Americans and the Europeans and everybody talking about a two-state solution, self-determination. Those words are meaningless unless they have some muscle behind them. And this is remains missing. Kamala Harris must be in the most uncomfortable position in the world because she has tried with verbal messages to express a more reasonable approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to rein in the Israeli excesses militarily and the genocide, and to humanize the Palestinians and their suffering, saying this has to end, and talking of self-determination and two states. But she can't do any of that as vice president. She has to wait till she's nominated after August 20. And when she is then the official candidate of the Democratic Party, if she's serious, she then will have an opportunity to show if she's going to actually do something. And this is something that's critical because it may cost her the election. There are large numbers, millions of Americans, progressive Americans, Arab Muslim Americans, Jewish progressive Americans, all kinds of people, labor unions who want the U.S. support for the Israeli genocide to stop.
Rami, we're going to have to leave it there. But of course, we're going to continue to cover this issue in our next segment, talk about Kamala Harris. Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, non-resident senior fellow at Arab Center, Washington. Karim Makdisi, speaking to us from Beirut, a professor at the American University of Beirut. And Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and Haaretz columnist, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Thank you all so much. Coming up, law professor Kimberly Crenshaw of the African-American Policy Forum. She's in Nashville. We'll talk about Kamala Harris's historic campaign, racist Republican attacks against her, and much more. Back in 20 seconds. Fear no one, by salt. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This week, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump continued his racist attacks on the Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Here's Trump on Fox News Monday night, interviewed by Laura Ingraham.
Number one, they had an incompetent man as president, okay? Now they have somebody who's worse. She's sort of incompetent. She's not very smart, but she's very radical. Very radical. She will try and defund the police.
How would they consider a Harris presidency? Just in GOP?
I think they'll walk all over her.
How so?
They'll look at her. I think they'll walk all over her. She'll be so easy for them. She'll be like a play toy. They look at her and they say, we can't believe we got so lucky. They're going to walk all over her. And I don't want to say as to why, but a lot of people understand it.
During a campaign event in Atlanta Tuesday evening, Vice President Kamala Harris challenged Trump to meet her on the debate stage so she could address his criticisms directly.
Well, Donald, I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage.
President Trump has called Kamala Harris dumb, dumb as a rock, a bum, and has called her evil. To discuss Harris's historic campaign and more, we're joined by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, professor of law at UCLA and Columbia University, executive director of the African American Policy Forum, which is hosting their annual Critical Race Theory Seminars Summer School in Nashville this week, where she is joining us from now. Speakers include Ben Crump, talking about the police killing of Sonya Massey. Their opening plenary was called Tip of the Spear, Tennessee on the Front Lines of the War on Woke. Professor Crenshaw, thanks so much for being with us. Can you respond to what Kamala Harris said last night, her first big campaign rally? Thousands were there. And talk about what the Republicans are saying out of so many Congress members' mouths, DEI higher, mediocre. Mm. This is all about DEI, they say.
Well, first of all, one has to respond with just applause. I mean, it was such a perfectly delivered challenge to Donald Trump. But look, here's the reality. As much as Kamala Harris's likely nomination is galvanizing people around the country, she's also serving as an avatar for all the fears of people who fear the browning of America, those who fear the browning of America more than they fear the rise of fascism in the United States. So the challenge is quite clearly that those who support Kamala Harris and those who support our democracy have to take back the ground that they have conceded to the war against woke. This attack on her as the DEI candidacy is a direct consequence of the fact that the attack on the entire infrastructure of racial justice, the entire last half of the 20th century and the first half of the 21st century has largely been conceded by progressives, by liberals, and by moderates, those who don't want to talk about the attack on racial justice, those who think that we can just ignore the racism on the right and ignore the racism that is being played out in Project 2025. So this is a moment where there's interest convergence between those of us who understand the relationship between racial justice and democracy and those who are deeply concerned about the descent of our country and what will happen under another Trump administration. We cannot defend democracy. We cannot defend Kamala Harris without taking on directly the intersection of racism and sexism that we are seeing playing out across this campaign. And so the summer school that we've been having and that we're having is designed to provide precisely those tools, the literacy that's necessary and the courage, frankly, to meet this battle where it actually is.
And Kimberly Crenshaw, also we're witnessing the hypersexualization of Kamala Harris, including the circulation of derogatory slogans and rumors about her personal life. A media figure, Megyn Kelly, even saying that Kamala Harris slept her way to the top. Can you talk about the significance of this targeting of Harris with these kinds of claims?
Well, look, one of the insights of intersectionality is that racism and sexism are not simply additive. It's almost like an algebra equation. She's going to suffer both the misogyny that we saw play out with Hillary Clinton's campaign, the racism that we saw playing out with Barack Obama, but also without a deep understanding about how misogynoir comes together to shape how African American women in particular are viewed, how they've been stereotyped over the course of history. So this is a moment where all those who support democracy and all those who support this candidacy have to quickly come together and learn how to read this attack on her, know how to respond to this attack on her, and quite frankly, connect it to the attacks on other black women. We talked about Sonia Massey yesterday when Ben Crump was here, and he talked about how the autopsy reports actually support the video that she was in a crouched position. She was shot from top to from above her. This kind of degradation, dehumanization is deeply part of our history, and there's a particular way that it plays out against women who are of African descent. So we are going to have to up our game. We're going to have to not pivot away from the attacks. We're going to have to meet them where they are, and we're going to have to make it clear that Kamala Harris's campaign offers much more to the white working class. That everybody wonders, will she appeal to them? They're not wondering why the white working class is not turned off by Donald Trump's billionaire focus agenda. We got to talk about these things, and we've got to disarm the war on woke. It's like a gun that's been loaded and it's on the table and it's available to be targeted at things that people clearly care about, which is our democracy.
And do you have any concern on substantive issues, for instance, that the Harris campaign's websites, even after her endorsement by President Joe Biden and former President Obama, does not have a platform or policies on it that explain what her particular policies will be if elected in office?
Well, you know, it is early in the campaign. So one of the things that we know for certain is that this is a campaign that is about rescuing our democracy from the cliff that we are on. And look, we got lucky that we were able to save the democracy when we did. But look, we're not talking about the real threat. The real threat to our democracy that marched through that Capitol was the threat that was symbolized by that Confederate flag. There are those who fear sharing this country with all of us who were in it. If you look at the basic argument about the stolen election, who stole it? It was voters in Philadelphia, in Detroit, in Milwaukee, in Phoenix. They are saying what the quiet part is out loud. So we know at minimum that the Harris campaign is about addressing the threat to our democracy. Now, of course, we're going to have to push the Democrats. We're going to have to push Kamala Harris to actually make good on the right to democracy, the freedom to learn, all the reproductive freedom. We know that the election is just the first part. The second part is maintaining the mobilization that put her there. That's the mistake that we made earlier on, and we can't make that mistake again. So as we come together to save our democracy, we also have to come together to be a governing majority in that democracy. That's what we're here to celebrate. That's what we're here to commemorate. Freedom Summer 1964 is the precursor to Freedom Summer 2024. This is the tip of the spear. This is why we are here.
Kimberly Crenshaw, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor of Law at UCLA and Columbia University and Executive Director of the African American Policy Forum, hosting the annual Critical Race Theory Summer School in Nashville. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rocks. CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.